Hello, everyone, and welcome to the CCW podcast. This is Al.
Hi, everybody. It's Dagny.
Hey, welcome to episode 14. We're going to call this one The Lessons of Mel Tappan. I'm going to let Dagny here take the lead on this one because basically she read a book by Mel Tappan. And if you don't know who Mel Tappan is, I didn't know who Mel Tappan was before I started listening to some podcasts, in particular a podcast by Chip Monk. That's his name. And Chip Monk Family Survival is one of these podcasts that I got involved with, or at least gotten to listen to. And he kept highly recommending Mel Tappan.
Yeah, he kind of has what he calls a survival library. It's a little bit different vein podcast than what we are, but he's big on books and we're big readers, so we checked out some of the stuff. And this particular book is one of them.
Yeah, and so Dagny took a good look at it and pretty much read the chapter on tactics and decided to incorporate it into a podcast. And I'll chime in when and where I can. But again, this is going to be heavily based on a book by Mel Tappan. I don't know if I said the name. Survival Guns is the name of it. And without further ado, Dagny, take it away.
Okay, so Survival Guns, for the most part, is about choosing weapons and which ones are going to have kind of strategic advantages over other ones. And that's not what we're diving into tonight. I haven't read the whole book. I focused in on this one particular chapter.
And maybe before we start, it's a pretty old book, isn't it? So some of the technology, like for instance, I don't even think it talks about the Glock.
No, not at all. He talks about, well, first of all, we'll say we have a reissue or a reprinting, but the original is from the 70s. And let's see, original 76, and our copy is from 2009, and it has a new foreword kind of bringing it up to speed with current events, which are surprisingly similar to what the actual book from the 70s talks about with the Mideast and oil prices and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And that's where he's coming from through the rest of it. Political climate aside, the chapter on the tactics and kind of training with the guns is what tonight's podcast is about.
Yeah, I think the foreword is written by his wife because they think he passed away.
Yeah, and really good writer. Hopefully some of you will check it out. We'll get some stuff on the blog, I promise. I know we've been talking about it for a while, but I'll link to the book for everybody in the next couple of days here. Very good writer, very relatable. He's not condescending in any way, even though he is a real master of the guns that were around when he was around. Do you have anything else to say about that, Al?
Yeah, just from what I remember listening to Chip, and this is mostly from his own podcast, he said something about Mel Tappan being married to, at the time, a very wealthy woman, to the point where he didn't have to necessarily work for a living. So he essentially had an unlimited budget and was able to order 5 or 10 different versions of the same firearm.
Right. He got to do what a lot of us would probably like to do, is buy the weapons and review them and, you know, really get to play with them.
Right. And give his own unbiased opinion. So that was kind of interesting. Again, that was just secondhand information, but it was a little background that might be interesting to some people. It's many of the guns are still around that he talks about, and he talks a lot about long arms, rifles and shotguns, and I'm not sure what's out of date and what's still relevant, but it seems like his ideas, especially from what we did, what we talked about preparing for the podcast, seems like a lot of his ideas are still very germane.
Sure. So to kind of dig into it, he presents the chapter saying if you are in a defensive situation, you are already at a strategic disadvantage because someone has acted on you, and you need to overcome them and outskill them, or, you know, one-up them, be better than them in three different regards: the weapons you have, the skills you have, and your mental conditioning. And the whole book is basically on the weapons, and like I said, I haven't read the entire book, a little more in depth than what I guess I'm ready to learn, but I guess he goes into how to modify your weapons, choosing the right weapon for the right task, long guns versus handguns, that sort of stuff. So, I mean, the whole book would address that. He doesn't go into that really too much in this chapter. The skill, you know, your basic training, that's really the meat of this chapter. And then the mental conditioning, he talks about a little bit. And he notes that your weapons and your skill, in a lot of ways, if you're actively trying to train and prepare for a defensive situation, you are already at an advantage over a likely attacker, just because he notes, one, they usually steal their weapons, criminals, and people that they're going to steal weapons from probably don't have the greatest weapons because they're not making efforts to protect their weapons. It's just kind of a little doing some surmising there.
So basically, he's saying if you're faced with an attacker, you're already kind of put behind the eight ball. You're already at a disadvantage right from the get-go just by virtue of someone being on the offensive, and that your three factors to consider is, one, your weapons, two, your training or your skills, and then three, your mindset.
Yep, that's right.
And that the attacker, generally speaking, may have inferior or, you know, substandard weapons.
As well as skill, he talks about how there's this perception by a fair amount of people that criminals are really apt at using weapons, but the reality is a lot of them just have a really rudimentary knowledge of how a gun works and probably don't have any formal training at all with firearms.
Right. Your hope that they're not out at the range every couple of weeks practicing their isosceles stance.
Right. And this isn't to say that you shouldn't practice anticipating someone who's completely unknowledgeable on these topics.
Right. You shouldn't expect the person to be completely untrained, but it seems to me from what Mel Tappan said, most criminals are, in fact, not trained shooters. Which makes sense to me, I think.
Yeah, it does make a lot of sense. You don't want to stereotype, but for most, I mean, I would think that a lot of times the incidents that you hear about in the news are a bit more atypical maybe than the run-of-the-mill incidents that involve, you know, criminals with guns.
Right.
I don't know.
I mean, I'm envisioning the person who holds the gun gangsta style, you know, with the gun sideways and kind of punches out their hand, you know, with each pop. Yeah, I'm picturing a rap song or something. But yeah, I mean, so you got to have better weapons, which I think if you're pretty much buying a mainstream brand name firearm made in the last 10 years, you're pretty much going to have better weapons, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a good weapon, I think.
And the skill, your training, I mean, if our listeners are CCW or concealed license holders or whatever, there's a certain level of training that even goes along with that. And that is possibly more than what a criminal would have as far as training goes.
Right, definitely, I think. Yeah, I think that, at least with our experience in the CCW class, we got a basic foundation of training that I think we're very happy with.
Yeah, and they covered a lot of stuff really briefly that this chapter goes into, which the next points he goes into are basically how to fire the weapon, really basic, and you've got your grip, your sight picture, your breath control, and your trigger control, and he goes into those in this chapter in varying depth. We'll kind of augment this content with, you know, our own experiences and what we've learned from classes and other reading. So do you have anything else to add before we move on?
Well, those sound sort of like, when you said grip and sight alignment, sight picture and all that stuff, it sounds more like, I guess, fundamentals of marksmanship. We can talk a little bit about that.
Sure. Do you want to go ahead and start?
Yeah, you said grip. You know, I think everyone wants to get a high grip, meaning, you know, get it as close to the slide as possible. And you want to put the, you know, your grip, high tang grip. If you have a 1911, you want to make sure you're disengaging that grip safety. Or if you have a Springfield XD, they have grip safeties as well, so you want to be high up on it. I also, sorry if I'm wheezing, guys, I'm fighting something. But you want to also have a good stance, staggered stance. And this is from pretty much my head and notes, not from necessarily Mel Tappan, but I'm sure he echoes some. And if you want to chime in where he disagrees, maybe. Stance you want to have staggered, we call it the fighter stance, something where you can move and fight and be balanced, stable. Basically, you're ready to go hand-to-hand if you need to. Side alignment, you basically pointing your firearm at the target, and it's really dependent upon grip and stance. You know, if you put the top of the front sight level with the two rear sights, you know, assuming that you use a three-dot system, and you want equal daylight between the front sight. And then there's also sight picture, which is basically creating the three levels of the target, the front and the rear sight, and you want to make them all aligned. And since you can't focus in on all three, you want to focus in on the front sight. And the front sight is, of course, the sight that's right above the muzzle of your firearm. And then once you have all those in trigger control, I think most professionals will agree, is the key. It's the most important, and it's where, if that's not handled, where most of the misses occur. And basically, it's a controlled pressure to the rear. It's smooth and it's straight to the rear. And the one thing I'm having problems with is holding it back upon firing. You want to hold it down and then disengage just enough to reset the trigger. So basically, it's a controlled pressure, smooth to the rear, gun goes off, you're still holding it down on the recoil, and then you begin to let it go, and that's what's called follow-through. You reset to the target, and then you reset your trigger, meaning that you let go of the trigger just enough to get another shot off. On the Glock, you can hear, in fact, the trigger reset. It's this audible click. When you let go just a little bit on the slack on your trigger finger, you can hear it click. And what I'm having problems with is when I tend to shoot, I shoot and then I let go completely. And then shoot, let go completely, to the point where my finger is almost all the way relaxed and not touching the trigger. I need to stay on the trigger and I think pull the trigger smooth, hold it down upon recoil, bring it back, and then just enough, but still contact the trigger, and then pull it back again to the rear to get good follow-through shots. So it's basically resetting to the target, resetting the trigger, stay on the trigger, regain the sight picture after your shot's fired, and then reset the trigger to be ready to fire again.
And Mel, in his chapter, definitely doesn't go into the trigger control as much, and he kind of combines the breath control and the trigger control. He says with the breath, you kind of want to engage that trigger about halfway through an exhalation.
Right, you take a deep breath in and then out, and then after, he said about half of his air?
That's what he said, about halfway.
Half of your air being exhaled, you pause.
Yeah.
And then you take your shot on that pause.
Yeah. And the trigger pull, it's kind of a thing of art, I guess. He goes into maybe a page description of what it's not to try and help the shooter experience from practice what it is. Mm-hmm. Because it's a very hard thing to describe, as he tries to do. And I'm not going to relate everything he says it's not. He just emphasizes, you know, you don't want to jerk it because you're going to, you know, ruin your sight picture and your sight alignment and be off target and all of these different things. To work back and see how all of these work in combination, you want your breath and trigger control, your sight picture, and your grip. All of those skills in combination, the goals you're trying to reach are your accuracy, your power, and your speed. And he talks about how the speed comes in time with practice and perfection of your accuracy. And then the power is once again something that the rest of the book and, you know, other resources would help you refine. He basically says that the power comes down to the weapon you choose and the cartridge you choose. And this is where some of his information and his preferences are probably out of date. Although Al would probably like it, he does say that the best is a 45 ACP, which I know is music to Al's ears, right?
Hey, you know, Mel Tappan's a smart guy.
And then the accuracy. So basically, to sum it up, your accuracy, you want to hit the other person. Your speed, before they hit you, and the power, you want to hit them before they hit you with enough force to stop them. So it kind of sums up those three main goals, and he goes a little bit more into your grip.
I like what you said, though. Maybe you repeat that again. What did he say?
He sums up your goals of accuracy, speed, and power by basically saying you need to hit them before they hit you with enough force to stop them.
So you need to hit them with enough force to stop them before they hit you, basically.
Yes. To summarize it.
That's pretty much it, isn't it? That's the if you have to engage, right? I mean, obviously, if you don't, then you get out of that situation and, you know, live to fight another day. But if not, hit them before they hit you and hit them with enough force to stop them. That's the name of the game right there, I think.
Yeah, it is. And later in the chapter, and I'll get to it after we kind of go over these fundamentals a little bit more, he talks about the mental preparedness that goes into that whole mindset of being able to hit and stop them before they hit you.
Yeah, and just one more thing on the power, firepower, the power part of that accuracy, power, and speed. When he wrote this book, I don't think that we'd made nearly as many strides as we have right now in effective hollow points, so I could definitely see that maybe back then the 45 was the undisputed king, but I think the more and more I'm researching, you know, I'm realizing that some of the best 9mm hollow points are as every bit as devastating as certainly the 45 ACP ball and even some of the 45 ACP hollow points. So the argument about, you know, 9mm not being so great, maybe that he may have made, I don't know if he'd made that argument or not, but you know, the definition of power, I think, is different now. And I think, you know, you're not underarmed by any means if you have a high-tech 9mm bullet like the Winchester Ranger 127 grain plus P+.
Not to get into specifics.
Well, that's a pretty cool round from everything I'm reading, and it shoots real easy. So and the guys at Pro Arms Podcast seem to think that it can do devastating damage because they've actually done it. So, you know, that's I'm just trying to think that maybe back in when Mel was writing this, the strides in ammunition wasn't nearly as broad as it is now.
Sure. And that's probably, you know, subject matter for a whole different podcast, is really getting into the most current stuff on stopping power and kind of addressing some myths or fallacies or common beliefs, but not for tonight. So we'll go on to the grip. He talks about, and Al mentioned it before too, you called it staggered stance. Mel refers to it as weaver. I think we've referred to it in other podcasts ourselves as weaver stance. It's where, you know, your shooting side's foot is behind the non-dominant side's foot. So you step that non-shooting hand, that side's leg forward. And this results in what he calls your push-pull opposing force grip. You're pushing out with your shooting hand, and then your grip with your supporting hand is pulling it back to control your muscle movement. He calls it your unconscious, like, neuromuscular movement. You're controlling that, and you're also controlling the recoil by having this push-pull stance. Isosceles stance, I looked back in my notes from my CCW class that I took, is called push-push or pull-pull. It's double instead of the push-pull. And it's just because you've got equal weight on both of your legs.
It sounds to me like it'd be push-push, isn't you?
Yeah, I believe it's push-push. And so he prefers that push-pull, believes that you get your better balance that way, and also that with that staggered stance, with a pivot to either side, you can cover 180 degrees of your surroundings very readily.
There's he sounds to me like he's maybe a disciple of Jeff Cooper. who some of you are more experienced listeners might know, was sort of the proponent of, kind of brought back the 1911, I guess, to ultra popularity. And he was a big fan of the 45 ACP round, and I'm very much a proponent of the Weaver stance, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, he actually later in the chapter does mention Jeff Cooper, but more under the mental preparation.
Sure, yeah. I think he was a colonel. Colonel Cooper, I think, also sort of brought to the forefront the condition colors, condition yellow, condition, you know, don't be condition white, be condition yellow at all times. But that's another podcast, and we can talk about that some other time, maybe.
Also, a part of the grip, he talks about what he prefers, and he didn't really, I don't know that it was the name he called it as much as just a description, a basic clasp grip. And with this, he just gripped it like you always do with your shooting hand, and then the supporting hand comes up, and your pointer finger goes around the front of the trigger guard, right under the barrel, and then your thumb on your support hand is resting on, let's see, and your thumb is, all right, I said it backwards. He does not prefer the finger forward. I'm describing the clasp. I got turned around here. Okay, the clasp, all four of your fingers on your support hand are under the trigger guard, and your thumb of your support hand is on top of your shooting thumb. So it's distanced from the barrel. His complaint or his caution with the finger forward, which I believe is what I use and what Al uses when you grip your gun, your support pointer finger goes around the front of the trigger guard, and that support thumb is below and parallel to the slide, is that if your thumb is too high, it can rip your fingernail off during the slide action and stuff. And he shows pictures. The chapter actually has a lot of photographs showing the different
grips. He doesn't show pictures of fingernails coming out, does he?
No, fortunately. But you just got to commit to one. You have to decide which one you're going to use so that, you know, when you face a situation, you draw, you're not fumbling around trying to decide which to use, and you need to commit your grip to your muscle memory.
Yeah, definitely. I agree with that. And at least committing the grip to muscle memory. Right now, I'm still kind of tweaking my grip, but on the Glocks, on the front of the trigger guard, there is sort of these grooves there that I think are meant for your support hand's index finger.
Exactly. He talks about in there that some of the trigger guards are squared off or even have texture designed for that grip, so that's what you're experiencing there.
Yeah, but right now, my two-handed grip is, you know, the right hand, my main hand. It squeezes really hard from front to back and back to front, I guess, so to speak. I just try to crush it, and my trigger finger is pointing towards the target. It's off the trigger. And then I put my thumb. I try to make my thumb completely in the same line as my forearm and have that point towards the target.
And this is on his supporting hand.
Yeah, this is my support hand. And then I fill the gap left by my firing hand on the frame. There's a big gap right there on the left side of the frame of the grip, and I put my pad of my palm there and kind of cushion, fill that black with the pad of my palm, the rear pad of my palm, and then align the thumb so it's running straight towards the target along the frame. So basically my index finger on my firing hand and my thumb of my support hand are both pointing right at the target on both sides of the frame.
And so, I think for listeners too, I think we kind of described this pretty thoroughly in episode 4 maybe.
Yeah, and my support hand trigger finger is not on the trigger guard. It's actually underneath the trigger guard. It's actually on top of the other three fingers of my firing hand, other than my trigger finger.
So it's almost like a hybrid between what he calls clasp and what he calls finger forward.
Yeah, exactly.
It might kind of be a nature of having shorter fingers that can't wrap as easily around that trigger.
What are you trying to say?
I'm just saying I've got small hands. I wouldn't probably be able to wrap.
Oh man, we got to edit that out, guys.
No offense.
That's
meant
not
there.
Staying in, guys.
Anyway, with the grip and throughout the chapter on the different things he talks about, he does suggest training. It is a tactical chapter, and I don't know how in-depth I'll go, but with the grip, I thought it was really interesting. He recommended doing 20-minute practices on your grip twice daily for a week, and he said you will be sore in muscles you didn't know you had, that you didn't know you used, just trying to perfect this grip. So food for thought, I guess, you know, practice makes perfect. You're going to get that in your muscle memory. Only a week. That's not bad.
Right. And, you know, I guess this is the point where we should say, hey guys, you know, get training out there. Don't rely on two beginners like us to, you know, provide you with enough training on your own. You know, you don't want to develop bad principles if you're new at this. So you definitely want to get someone who is knowledgeable in the field in your area. And if you don't know who that is, maybe check the forums and ask the right questions and learn the good basics. And we're giving you ideas and we're just throwing them out there. But, you know, implementing them is a completely different matter. So obviously get professional help with all this stuff. And for all you old pros, you know, getting professional help might be a good refresher if nothing else, right? So we'll see. You know, it's just, this is a podcast and we're obviously limited with what we can do via just the spoken word. So with that grain of, you know, with that little caveat, go ahead.
The next thing that he focuses in on is your sight picture. And Al pretty much hit every point that Mel did in his book. You've got your front, your rear, and your target planes, and you simply cannot focus on all three. And from reading his, I couldn't tell if there's a real reason you focus on the front or just because it's the only one that you can't do without. I'm not sure. The point was,
well, I think to me it's since you can't focus in on all three, you focus in on the one in the middle. So that way you can kind of keep everything else in the peripheral vision of it, I guess.
Right. But the only thing that I could determine is that he says you can do without the rear sight. As long as it's blurry, as long as you can see that equal amount of white space between the front sight and the sides of the rear sight. And he calls the front sight the blade and the rear sight the leaf. So you want that equal amount of white space between the blade and the leaf when you've got them aligned. And you can also, even if that rear sight is blurry, you can tell if the tops of the blade and leaf are level, and that's what you need. That's really the key to shooting what you're aiming for. You don't need to have your target in perfect. No, it doesn't need to be perfect focused. It can be fuzzy because it's going to be pretty close, and you're shooting for center mass, and that should be able to stop them, and you're going to get the accuracy you need with a blurry rear sight. So that front sight is the key, and your sights, your blade and your leaf in relation to each other are more important than your sights in relation to the target. As far as a very precise point on your target goes, of course you need to be on target. But, you know, he goes into how you don't want to shoot for extremities because they're moving. And that includes the head, arms, and legs. And ammo could be scarce, especially if you've got multiple attackers. You need to make the most with the ammunition you have, and you need to make sure that you're going to hit someone, and that's why you're shooting for center mass. You're more likely to hit them even though they're moving. Just very, very good lessons, good refreshers that I'm sure all of us know and have learned in the past. So that about sums up the sight picture. He talks about, for practice on this element, dry firing as soon as possible after acquiring your sight picture, that you don't want to get that precise target alignment, and just you just don't want to perfect things too much. He said that that's one of the biggest things that holds people back in development of their skills is trying to get the perfect sight on the target as opposed to perfect sight picture.
Right. That's kind of like the BSA drills, the balance between speed and accuracy. You don't want to spend forever and a day waiting for that just perfect sight picture, you know. Get it there. Get it to where it's a little wobbly because it's going to be a little wobbly. And just get used to it, comfortable with that little wobble. And, you know, if you just try to get that shot off and, you know, try to be fast and balance the fast with the accurate until you're, you know, we'll get accurate first, right? And then get faster.
Right. And it's interesting because so many of us probably live in cities and don't have ready access to a range, specifically a range that would let you do quick draw or different drills that would probably really hone these skills. He mentions doing short, I have little quotation marks here, short practices of no more than an hour or an hour and a half at a time at the range, which is much more than an hour I have ever done at a single practice at a range. So, you know, everything's relative, and if you're really going for honing those skills, you've got to dedicate the time to it. And maintenance, he talks about spending X amount of hours per month on just maintenance of the skills you have acquired, because they do deteriorate over time.
Mm-hmm. I think that we're both still in that developing accuracy stage, and I don't think that we're at the stage where we're satisfied with accuracy, where we can build on speed. I mean, we're certainly faster than we used to be, but I still say we're probably still building accuracy.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And then something that I wasn't going to go too much into tonight, we don't have any experience with it, is kind of like icing on the cake when you've mastered these skills that we've already talked about, is your speed reloading so that you can have sustained fire if you are under attack from multiple people or they have more firepower than you. And he explains how to do it, and again he has photos to kind of show the steps, and says that after practice you should be able to effectively do this in like 2 seconds.
So speed reloading on a semi-auto would be changing a magazine out and putting a new magazine in and racking it and getting it ready to go again, right?
Right, and it's all while keeping your sight picture. You basically do not move the weapon, you release that magazine and use your other hand, your non-shooting hand, to stick the new one in.
Interesting, because I'm not sure that that's currently promoted by today's experts, I think, the keeping it on the target. I haven't heard that before in terms of reloading. I think some people just say get it to in your workspace or something, and generally it's your gun 45 degrees pointed, kind of with your palm facing your hand, your shooting hand, palm facing you, and having the gun tilted that way, and then taking out the mag that way and putting a new mag in, and then getting it back on target. It's interesting, though.
Yeah, and I don't, like we've said, this book is a little older, and also his intention in writing this book could also impact the methods that he's promoting within it.
Right, he's kind of talking about it in a when the, you know, in a crisis situation, I guess, to be a little crass, when the S hits the fan type situation, whether it be economic collapse or you know, who knows what, natural disasters or EMPs and all that
kind
stuff.
Of mass chaos, not like a random act of violence.
Right, and what we're focused in on are more realistic defense type situations that an average citizen would encounter on a day-to-day basis, or maybe even a once-in-a-lifetime encounter, but still nothing that affects more than just you and your family type of situation, you know, like a break-in at night, or you're out on the streets and encounter someone who means you harm.
Beyond these things under skills, he would suggest next to start practicing with your non-dominant hand, and that would be all of the elements above, your grip, your sight picture, and practicing those with your non-dominant hand. And I mean, if you want to try to carry on the opposite side, but also something as simple as drawing from your dominant side with your non-dominant hand in case, say, you're confronted with a situation where your shooting hand is injured, but you're still carrying as if you're going to be shooting with that hand. So very valuable skills. And then finally, he talks a little bit about point shooting, and really, he doesn't discourage it, but emphasizes that it's not something that you should really take up until you have mastered your two-handed aimed target shooting. This is your priority. Really, your point shooting is last resort if you have to engage and it's really close quarters and maybe you can't use both hands for some reason if you're holding a flashlight at night or you're injured. He doesn't go into it a whole lot.
And point shooting is just sticking the gun out towards the target and pulling the trigger, right? And it's not really enough time to align your sights or even use your sights. It's just a last-ditch point, pull, and hope you hit the target, right?
Right, and that's why he says arm's length and you need your maximum speed to get a shot off so you wouldn't have time to maybe, you know, use your sight alignment. But of course, if you have practiced your sight picture with your weapon and it's all in muscle memory, I mean, I would imagine someone who's really familiar with their gun could approach, you know, really good form with sight picture if they're familiar with their weapon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so like they almost take an aimed point shot.
Yeah.
When they're using the sights.
Yeah. And I have noted down here, he mentioned No Second Place Winner by Bill Jordan as a book that kind of talks about the point shooting. And I didn't take any notes on that, but something that might be worth referencing. He also mentioned Jeff Cooper, who Al mentioned a little bit ago, under mental preparation. And I would talk about situational awareness here. And Al mentioned with Jeff Cooper the different color conditions and just being aware of what's going on around you. Al, do you want to go into that a little bit more? Maybe explain what these color conditions are for people who maybe don't know?
Well, I think Colonel Cooper basically started with the idea that we're all, most of us, walk around in condition white. Meaning we don't have a care in the world. We don't know, you know, sometimes we don't even know how we drove from here to work or work to home or work to the market. We just don't know because we're not really paying attention. And he recommends that most of us who are serious about defending ourselves and our loved ones should be in condition yellow, which is the next step up. And that stage is mostly a relaxed awareness where you are completely aware of your surroundings, of what you're doing, of any interesting figures around you. You kind of have made mental note of their location. You know, if you enter a building, you know exactly how to get out of that building and you know how you came in and maybe a couple of other alternative ways to get out. And then the step up from that, I think, is condition orange, is when you've found a particular threat, I guess, that you're now aware of, and most of your energy then is there. And condition red is the next one above that, and that is when that particular threat has become actualized, where you are fully able and ready to use lethal force, I guess, if you had a firearm with you. Basically, you're prepared to fully act and defend yourself. And I don't know if I did those condition colors justice, but you can definitely find them online easy. And some of the other podcasts, I'm sure, have dealt with the conditions as well. And they're basically condition white through condition red. So, and red is the situation where you have to defend yourself and you're ready to do it, and you do it. That was the color conditions.
Yeah, and he also, he talks about it in a little bit different ways in his own voice, psychological terms, and talking about how you kind of go into that automatic state where you're kind of moving through life without realizing it. And he mentions driving without realizing that you were driving and you're suddenly home.
I think today's cubicle world, that we live in. I mean, most people do kind of act like zombies, you know. We just kind of shuffle step to through life, you know. And I think this condition scheme is theory is pretty much based on, you know, being aware in the moment. I don't know, it's kind of zen to see that, but be completely present in where you are, you know. Don't be daydreaming. Be completely aware of what you're doing, why you're doing it, and who else is doing it around you.
Yeah, and kind of along those lines, it's about being aware of what's there and maybe what's not there. He also talked about how you're in a room and there's a lot of other stuff going on and there's a clock that's ticking, but you'll tune that out. And he talks about how there have been scientific tests done, like EEGs and things, that show that your brain actually literally tunes the stuff out. And he recommends meditation, actually, for kind of tuning back in and learning how to be more present in the moment. And he also, of course, recommended that book by Jeff Cooper called Principles of Personal Defense. And it just goes into the distinction between knowing how to shoot and being mentally prepared to take action. And this comes up in various stories of people who've gotten into gunfights. I know there are a couple Pro Arms episodes about it. Al and I recently watched the John Wayne movie, The Shootist. He talks about it. It comes up that, you know, that 1 second of deciding whether you're going to respond with force can make the difference. And the person who survives is the person who doesn't blink and takes action.
Right. The theory being, if two guys who know how to shoot and who are completely prepared to do it face off, I guess, against one another, it's the one person who doesn't hesitate, who knows exactly what to do and what they must do, even though they both know that. It's the person who can respond without that sort of hesitation, that second or split second of self-doubt, that will sometimes makes the difference. I definitely was the theme in The Shootist when someone asks the John Wayne character, you know, how has he done it? How has he been so successful? And he basically says he's found that when most people have to do it, they'll hesitate, you know, when they'll hesitate before pulling that trigger, and he won't, you know, and that has made the difference. I know that's Hollywood, but we've heard some real life shooters say that, haven't we?
Yeah, we have, and it really stuck out. I heard the one podcast before I saw the movie, and it was like word for word, and I'm sure that people have been in gunfights. It is the reality, and they can see that really clearly on reflection, and so it's just kind of a universal thing that people must experience.
Yeah, the Duke said it best, so why create it if he said it perfectly?
Yeah, and then to wrap it up, he kind of goes into tactics if you're going to engage. And there's 4 things that he goes over. The first one is don't bluff. I mean, if you're going to draw your gun, you're going to fire the gun. You don't pull it and then have a conversation with your aggressor or try to negotiate. If you're prepared to draw, you need to be prepared to shoot. You need to do it. You don't wait. And he talks about I don't know if they're actually experiments or how he phrases it, but where they have someone in like an audience, so it must be like a magic show. I don't know exactly the context, but someone with an unloaded but cocked weapon pointed at the person on stage, and they look all relaxed and they can draw and, you know, cock it and fire before the person holding the cocked unloaded weapon can pull the trigger. And it's that issue of don't bluff. You don't pull the gun and then think about whether you're going to use it. When you pull it, you're ready to use it. And it kind of reminds me of a TV show that we've watched called Justified, where, you know, this, I don't know, is it a marshal, Alex, the character?
Yep, it's a U.S. marshal.
And he's quick draw. I mean, that's what he does. And, you know, he'll be, you know, at gunpoint, and they won't even know he has a weapon on him, and he'll be able to draw and shoot him before they even know what happened. And that's kind of that don't bluff. You can know your options without having them on the table, and you're going to do yourself a better service for that.
Yeah, I mean, my big caveat there would be don't bluff if, you know, someone is prepared to take your life, right? We have, we're reading another book. We're reading a book called Gunfight by Adam Winkler. That kind of goes into the legal arguments about the Second Amendment fight. And he, in it, I believe, says that 95% of people who draw guns don't have to end up using it, and have been able to kind of resolve the situation without shooting. So this don't bluff is only in the case where somebody is definitely prepared to take your life, and you will lose your life if you don't do something about it, I guess, so to speak, right? Wouldn't you say?
Right. I mean, all of this for self-defense purposes is it's not assuming that someone, you are prepared to use the lethal force in self-defense as your last resort always.
Right. I mean, if someone's coming at you and looks kind of shady and you're not sure what they're about and their hands in their pocket and you think they have a gun and all that stuff, but he hasn't done anything, and then you pull the gun out and shoot, that's not by any means what we're advocating, or what Mel Tappan was advocating. I think Mel Tappan was saying, you know, if you're in condition red and if someone's got the means and the ability and puts you in jeopardy to take your life away, don't, that's not the time to start bluffing and saying, you know, hey, you know, one false move and I'll blast you type of thing. That's the point where you need to act, or you or your loved ones lose their lives, you know? So.
Right. It literally becomes that do or die situation. I think the point is, if you're still at a position where you're feeling out whether you can talk the person down, you may not need the weapon to do it. I think that there's, you know, there's that line between pulling it and blinking an eye and then risking your life by not acting and then, you know, bluffing. And just be prepared. It's all mental preparedness, I guess.
Right. It's the ultimate last resort, right? The pulling of the trigger. And you're only pulling the trigger if you, you know, firmly believe that if you do not, that you will lose your life, you know. I also think that he talks about warning shots, right?
Right, and he kind of nested that as don't bluff, but a separate point.
Right, you don't know warning shots, right? We're not, this isn't the movies. You don't fire warning shots because, as Clint Smith from Thunder Ranch said, every bullet has an attorney attached to it.
That's a good way of putting it. He also says, never let your adversary get too close. I mean, it's another one of those movie things. You don't direct someone with the muzzle of the gun. You don't let him get too close. He said, unless you're firing actively at them, a handgun is really easily wrestled away from someone. You just don't. I think he says like 12 feet is as close as he likes someone to get to a weapon.
Right. A fundamental defensive fighting theory is to create distance. If the theory being, if that person, if you can touch that person, they can touch you. And if they can touch you, they can touch your gun. And if they can touch your gun, they can disarm your gun probably. So definitely, I like that rule. And definitely, some of the Mel Tappan's, tactics here, I might question, but that one I certainly do not.
And the final one he brings up is if you're shooting, you aim for that center mass, and kind of talked about it earlier, you know. There's a reason you don't aim for the extremities, is because the person's likely moving and you're not going to hit your target. And, you know, seconds count. Ammunition could very well count if you're, you know, being accosted, especially if there's multiple people. You have a better shot of hitting someone if you're shooting for center mass and you're trying to stop them, right? It goes back to that goal of accuracy.
Yep, definitely. Center mass seems to be the prevalent school of thought, that as long as you get it somewhere on that center mass, they're not particularly, at least in defensive shooting classes, concerned with if you get it in the bullseye center X-ring or a few circles outside of it, you know?
Yeah, and I mean, Mel throughout the chapter kind of talks about when you're doing practices, your clusters, and maybe practicing with a target that doesn't have circles to kind of score it. You just are looking to get it on the target. And all of that, you know, take it for what it's worth. All of this stuff, I mean, the very basic skills with the grip and the sight picture and the breath and trigger control are pretty standard. some of the other stuff is questionable, and some of his information and the weapons and stuff is perhaps outdated, but the fundamentals are pretty solid, I think.
From a book that was written in the 70s about firearms and about firearm tactics, Survival Guns by Mel Tappan is good stuff. And he does, I mean, Dagny mentioned it before, he writes in a way that's very accessible and it's very entertaining. It's a good read, even if you weren't into the subject matter. I mean, that's how good of a writer he is. And this is probably going to be the first of many book reviews that we do. And we thought of all the things that we could have started with, the Mel Tappan book, Survival Guns, was the only right way to start it, because this guy, he's good. He's good. And it's interesting to read what's still absolutely relevant and what has kind of been surpassed in today's doctrine, I guess, of combative training, you know, of gunfighting and whatnot. So some principles are timeless. Some have gone the way of the dodo. So it's been interesting to have you lead this discussion, Dagny.
Well, thank you. And I guess if there's one thing you take away, it's to hit them before they hit you with enough force to stop them.
Yeah, that is words of wisdom from Mel Tappan and from Alan Dagny, I guess. And one thing about our wrap-up thing is Semper Potare. I guess I never spelled it for folks. It was on our website. But Semper Potare, always carry, right? I brought that up last episode. It's Latin, and it's kind of something that I've been trying to get the word out on, at least via this podcast. It's spelled S-E-M-P-E-R, and Potare is P-O-R-T-A-R-E. Semper Potare. You got that, Andrew?
Oh, if you want to email us, just say hi, ask us some questions, give us some feedback. You can email us at ccwpodcast@gmail.com.
Yeah, and you can check us out at ccwpodcast.podomatic.com, P-O-D-O-M-A-T-I-C. That's our podcast website. You can also find us at ccwshow.blogspot.com. That's where Dagny will work on our website and update our blog and make it much more informative than it is right now with me in control.
Yeah, hopefully maybe that's a little less intimidating for some of our listeners who haven't emailed us or, you know, maybe want to start a dialogue, but email's a little too personal. So we'll get that going here in the next day or so.
Hey, you know, if you guys want to create an email account, do it, and just specifically for the purpose of communicating with us. We obviously respect your privacy. We'd like you to respect ours, of course. But if you're uncomfortable with, you know, your real email address, just make one. I mean, Gmail, Hotmail, all those accounts are free now. So if that's the way it'll take you to email us, fine by me. And to all the people who do email us regularly, thank you so much for it. We get excited each and every time we see one of your emails pop up in the email box, so inbox. So this is a long podcast, so it's pretty cool.
Yeah, for not being sure how impromptu this was.
Yeah, right? We're always thinking, oh man, we're running out of content. What could we talk about? And here we are almost an hour in. So, anything else you want to talk about?
I don't think so. I guess I just say stay tuned, everybody.
Semper Potare.